page 240, Unit 3, Georgia in the Revolutionary Era. During the Royal Period, Georgia had gone from being a young and weak colony to becoming more like the other British colonies in America. Yet, while the 1760s and 1770s were a time of growth for this youngest of the original colonies, it was also a time of growing discontent and disagreement with the mother country. Like the other colonies, Georgia opposed the new British colonial policies that emerged after the French and Indian War. Eventually, these disagreements led to conflict and finally to a movement for independence. Georgia was more cautious than its fellow colonies in participating in outright rebellion, but the colony eventually did join with the others in declaring and fighting for independence. The American Revolution was bloody in Georgia, with neighbor fighting neighbor. In the early years, the revolutionaries controlled the state after the royal government collapsed and fled. In December 1778, the British recaptured Georgia, at least most of the coast. In spite of their efforts, the British were never able to control the backcountry. As a result, Georgia was divided between royal and revolutionary governments. Both the British and the revolutionaries had victories and defeats in the war in Georgia. Ultimately, however, the war for independence was won, and Georgia and the other 12 former colonies formed a new country. The first experiment in government was a confederation, a loose organization of the states with a very weak central government and powerful state governments. Problems with finances, diplomacy, and other issues of governing led to a movement to change that government. Meeting in Philadelphia in 1787, Georgia and 11 other states hammered out a new framework of government under the United States Constitution. Because of problems it had experienced in the 1780s, especially with the Creek Indians, Georgia was a strong supporter of this change. Georgia approved the Constitution and became the fourth state to join the United States of America. These three chapters are the story of this transition from royal colony to state. Page 242 contains a focus on the reading skill, finding the main idea. Page 243 contains signs of the times about population, fads, science inventions, music, and literature. Page 244, Chapter 11, The Road to Revolution. Chapter Preview, Terms, Confederation, Smuggling, Proclamation of 1763, Sugar Act, Stamp Act, Repeal, Boycott, Intolerable Acts, Provincial Congress, Council of Safety, Loyalist, Patriot, Declaration of Independence. People: Noble Wimberly Jones, Archibald Bullock, John Houston, Lyman Hall, Thomas Paine, Button Gwinnett, John J. Zubley. Places: Tondi's Tavern. The French and Indian War officially ended in February 1763 with the signing of the Treaty of Paris. The American colonies and their mother country, Great Britain, had fought together to defeat the French and their Indian allies and, after 1762, the Spanish. As you saw in Chapter 10, in the treaty, France gave all its territory in Canada and east of the Mississippi River to the British. In return, France kept two profitable sugar islands in the West Indies. Spain gave up Florida to the British in return for all the land west of the Mississippi River. The victory brought celebrations of patriotism in Great Britain and America, but the long-term effect was not what they expected. Only 12 years later, beginning with the battles of Lexington and Concord in Massachusetts, the Americans and British would be at war again, this time against each other. Page 246, Section 1, British Policies at the War's End. As you read, look for the effects of the French and Indian War, the Proclamation of 1763, various laws passed by Parliament and the colonists' reaction to them, terms, smuggling, Proclamation of 1763, Sugar Act, Stamp Act, repeal, boycott. The French and Indian War changed the relationship between Great Britain and its North American colonies in ways that neither side could foresee. As Great Britain tried to govern its larger territory, keep the Indians under control, and pay its debts, leaders developed what they called a new colonial policy. Much of the new policy was not really new, but involved better enforcement of existing laws that had been ignored. The colonists thought that after the French and Indian War, their relationship with Great Britain would go back to the way it had been before the war. They quickly became upset by the new British acts and began to respond with resistance. That caused Great Britain to pass other measures, which again met with defiance. Action after action made Great Britain and the colonies angrier with each other. By 1776, the colonies had determined to become their own country. Effects of the French and Indian War. The war against the French had been expensive for Great Britain, and the country already had a serious debt. It was the fourth major war Great Britain had fought since the 1690s. British citizens at home had grown weary of increasingly higher taxes. The British government needed money. It thought that, since the war had started as a way to help the colonies, the Americans should be willing to help pay for it and their continued defense. So the first effect of the war was that the British government began a policy of taxing the colonies in order to raise money. While the colonies had paid some trade taxes, taxes to pay for their colonial expenses had been determined by their own assemblies, not Parliament. This new policy caused major problems. Second, with the war over, Great Britain began to enforce a series of old trade laws called the Navigation Acts, which they had loosely enforced or ignored for many decades. One of these acts required that certain goods Great Britain needed, but did not produce, be placed on a list of items that could only be sold to Great Britain or to other British colonies. Georgia's rice, indigo, furs, and naval stores were all on that list. Georgia could thus not sell these products directly to France, for example. Another act said that only British or British colonial ships could carry goods to colonial ports. In other words, any goods from other countries had to be brought to the colonies in British ships. That gave British merchants control of trade with the colonies. Another act required that British products could only be bought from the mother country, and that the colonies could not make anything, such as hats, that would compete with British manufacturers. These acts made sure that colonies benefited the mother country, as mercantilism required. To avoid these acts, the colonists had turned to smuggling, secretly importing or exporting goods. The third effect of the French and Indian War was the continued presence of British soldiers in the colonies. After the war, the British government did not recall all the soldiers brought over to fight. Although the government said the soldiers were there for the colonists' protection, many thought they were there to keep an eye on the colonists. Many Americans came to resent them, especially in the northern colonies where most of the troops were stationed. When the British began to require the colonists to house and provide supplies for the troops, resentment grew. Georgia, being on the frontier, was different. Because the Indians still lived right on its borders, Georgia wanted the protection of British soldiers, although few actually came to Georgia. However, even Georgians did not agree with having to provide housing and supplies. Another effect of the war was the removal of the French from Canada and the land west of the Appalachian Mountains, and the removal of the Spanish from Florida. One of the major advantages to being part of the British Empire had been the protection offered by the mother country against these other European powers. Now that protection was not needed as much. Georgia no longer had to fear Spanish schemes from East and West Florida or problems with the French along the Gulf Coast. The Indians in those areas no longer had Spanish or French allies. These large changes, along with smaller ones, caused the relationship between Great Britain and its North American colonies to become increasingly tense. The events over the next 12 years show how these effects of the French and Indian War put the two sides on the road to revolution. The colonies became stronger and were able to imagine themselves being on their own. The Proclamation of 1763. When the war ended, many Native Americans were afraid that the colonists would begin to move into their lands. This was particularly true for the Native Americans living west of the Appalachian Mountains who had been allies of the French. North of the Ohio River, Chief Pontiac of the Ottawa said the French did not own the land and had no right to give it to the British. Several tribes joined the Ottawa and rebelled against the British in May 1763, attacking British forts. That was followed by raids in which settlers were killed. The British soldiers did bring the rebellion under control, but Pontiac did not surrender until 1766. When Pontiac's rebellion began, the British government was already working on an Indian policy. In October 1763, the British government, hoping to bring order to the area and prevent further problems with the Native Americans, issued the Proclamation of 1763. This document created a line along the crest of the Appalachian Mountains and forbade any settlement west of the line. Those already settled in the west were to leave. The year 1763 was also the year that Georgia Governor James Wright negotiated the Treaty of Augusta. In Chapter 10, you learned that this treaty opened up land for settlement between the Ogeechee and Savannah Rivers as far north as Little River. This new territory was not west of the Proclamation line, so Georgians were not negatively affected. In fact, Georgia indirectly benefited because some settlers from other colonies, especially Virginia and the Carolinas, came to Georgia to get land in the treaty area rather than move west across the Appalachian Mountains. The other British colonies, however, were upset. After all, one of the main reasons for the French and Indian War had been to gain control of the Ohio River Territory. Now they believed that their own government was protecting the very Indians who had been their enemies. Some colonists also wondered if the British wanted to keep them east of the Appalachians, where it might be easier to control them. The Sugar and Stamp Acts. With the colonists already unhappy about the Proclamation line, the British government began to enforce its trade policies and to enact new taxes. The Sugar Act of 1764 was the first of many new laws that angered the colonists. This law revised the tax on a major item of trade between the mainland colonies and the island colonies in the West Indies, molasses. The act also called for more customs officials, people who oversaw the goods coming into ports and made sure taxes were paid. For the British government to tax an import was not new. Parliament had long taxed goods to regulate trade within the empire. But enforcing the tax laws was new and would hurt merchants, especially the smugglers who had never bothered to pay a tax before. Instead, many had bribed customs officers to look the other way. The loudest protest came from the New England colonies, especially Massachusetts, where many made their living by smuggling. While Georgians were somewhat concerned about the 1764 Act, the first law that really made the Georgia colonists upset was the Stamp Act of 1765. This law required that stamps be placed on all printed materials and documents. Examples of items to be stamped included bills of sale of property, leases, newspapers, shipping clearances that allowed ships to leave port, licenses for businesses, diplomas, calendars, and even playing cards. The stamps were to be sold by stamp agents or masters. In Georgia and the other colonies, the Stamp Act brought up a larger question. Did the British government have the right to tax a colonial citizen directly? Up to this time, taxes on goods had been paid by the merchant. Those were indirect or external taxes. The Stamp Act would be paid by every citizen who used any kind of paper or had to have any kind of legal document. The colonists argued that this kind of direct or internal tax on citizens was a violation of their rights because they did not get to elect the people who passed it. The colonies had no representation in the British Parliament. The British government argued that the colonists had virtual representation because Parliament represented all British citizens wherever they lived. The colonists said they believed in actual representation, where those men eligible to vote got to elect the representatives. They thought the Stamp Act was taxation without representation. In some colonies, people protested in the streets over the Stamp Act. In Massachusetts, a mob tore up the house of Lieutenant Governor Thomas Hutchinson. The first reaction of Georgians, however, was calmer. The Commons House of Assembly asked William Knox, the Georgia agent in London, a person similar to a lobbyist today, to ask Parliament to repeal or take back the Stamp Act. When Knox said Parliament had a right to tax the colonies in this way, the Commons House fired him and tried to hire the South Carolina agent to also represent them. The Governor's Council would not agree to that, so Georgia had no agent for a couple of years. This division between the Council, the upper house, and the Commons House, the lower house, was a sign of more conflict to come. Organized protests. In the summer of 1765, the Massachusetts Assembly sent a letter to the assemblies of the other colonies. It was an invitation to send representatives to a meeting of all the colonies to decide what to do in response to the Stamp Act. Governor Wright did not want Georgia to participate, so he did not call the Commons House into session. As a result, Georgia did not have any official delegates at the Stamp Act Congress held in New York City. The fact that the governor did not even allow the Commons House to meet to talk about sending anyone made some Georgians very angry. In the fall of 1765, a group of Georgians opposed to the Stamp Act formed an organization called the Sons of Liberty. It was modeled on Sons of Liberty groups in other colonies. On October 25, 1765, a group gathered in front of Tondee's Tavern in Savannah. They had made an effigy, likeness, of a stamp agent, which they paraded through the streets, pretending to hang and then burned while a crowd cheered them on. The governor became alarmed at such a threatening display. Another demonstration took place in November. On the day the Stamp Act went into effect, nothing happened in Georgia because there were no stamps and no agent to sell them. The Sons of Liberty had already decided to ask the stamp master to resign as soon as he arrived. When the stamps finally arrived in December, Governor Wright ordered them to Fort Halifax on the edge of Savannah, where they were put under guard. Still, there was no agent to sell them. Ships could not leave without the stamped papers. Harvested rice, already loaded, could not be shipped out for sale. On January 3, 1766, the stamp agent, George Angus, finally arrived and began selling the stamps. The port reopened as ship captains paid their stamp tax and set sail. No other colony sold the hated stamps. The rice planters and merchants were glad to see their cargo transported, but some Georgians were unhappy that they had given in. South Carolina was particularly unhappy with Georgia for using the stamps and loudly said so. In February, a group of 250 men from the backcountry marched on Savannah in protest. they were met by 100 Rangers with guns. The Rangers were a full-time, paid provincial military force. No further stamps were sold in Georgia while it waited with the other colonies to see what actions the British government would take. Fortunately, Parliament repealed the Stamp Act in 1766. The colonists believed they had won, even though Parliament passed legislation saying it had the right to tax the colonists. Although the Stamp Act protest in Georgia had been mild compared to those in other colonies, Georgia was changed by the controversy. Governor Wright, while relieved that the crisis had passed, could not forget the threats of violence that he had witnessed. More taxes. In October 1767, the Georgia Gazette had news of a new set of taxes. The Townsend Revenue Act placed taxes on goods coming into the colonies, tea, glass, paint, paper, and other items. Parliament thought the colonists would not object since these were external, indirect, rather than internal taxes. But protest came quickly in many colonies, and Georgians read and heard about them. Once again, Massachusetts led the way with another letter proposing that the colonies unite to oppose the act. When the Commons House of Assembly tried to discuss the Massachusetts letter, the governor dissolved the legislature and sent the delegates home. Since the Stamp Act crisis, the Commons House and the governor were increasingly at odds. Several months later, organized opposition to the act had resulted in two large meetings in Savannah. At the second one, resolutions against the act were passed. Meanwhile, South Carolinians had begun a boycott, which meant they refused to buy most British-made goods. Once again, South Carolinians had taken a harder stand against the British law and saw their Georgia neighbors as being too soft. In fact, at a meeting, South Carolinians voted not to trade with Georgia. In 1770, Parliament voted to repeal all the Townsend taxes except the tax on tea. The boycott had hurt British merchants and trade. That was the second time the colonists believed they had gotten their way. The boycotts of British goods ended quickly, although many colonists still refused to drink British tea. Some colonists continued to drink tea, but tea that was smuggled in and therefore not taxed. The Speaker Controversy. After the repeal of the Townsend Act, tensions calmed some, although there were incidents in many colonies that kept things stirred up. Unfortunately for Georgians, the relationship between Governor Wright and the Commons House of Assembly was a problem. Wright was trying to do his job and support the British government, but he was also trying to explain to his superiors in Great Britain how these policies affected the colonists. One of the issues that became a problem was the man the Commons House chose to be its speaker. The speaker represented the Commons House to the governor and the council. In April 1771, the Commons House elected Noble Wimberley Jones to the position. He was the son of Noble Jones, the doctor and surveyor of the colony. Governor Wright would not approve the selection of the younger Jones because he had been a leader of the Sons of Liberty. After taking this action, Wright left Georgia and traveled to England for over a year. Merchant James Habersham, a member of the council, became the acting governor. When the Commons House again elected Jones, Habersham followed Wright's direction and vetoed his selection twice in the spring of 1772. When Wright returned in 1773, he was Sir James Wright, having been given a noble title by the king. The colonists welcomed him back and were genuinely happy about his honor. While he was in Great Britain, Wright had urged the government to change some of the policies the colonists did not like. But Wright also believed that it was his duty to enforce the government's policy, even if he did not agree with it. The colony might have remained quiet if Parliament had not passed another law that angered citizens in Georgia and the other colonies. Reviewing the section, 1. Define smuggling, repeal, boycott. 2. What is the difference between internal and external taxes? Why was that difference important? 3. Why did Georgians and the other colonists resist the new taxes imposed by Parliament? 4. Do you think the proclamation line was necessary? Why or why not? Page 254, Georgia Portraits, William Bartram's Trail. After the French and Indian War, the French had lost all the territory they had claimed east of the Mississippi River. Philadelphia Quaker and botanist, a scientist who studies plants, John Bartram, suggested to one of his influential friends that he could travel through the new lands in the southeast and record the natural world he found. His friend wrote back, "The king has named thee his botanist, to range over Georgia and the Floridas." On his expedition, Bartram took his 26-year-old son, William, who had a natural talent for drawing and painting. The young man became fascinated with the plants and animals he saw. In 1772, after failing at other work, William found a wealthy British supporter who agreed to sponsor another expedition to the southeast. William Bartram left from Charleston in March 1773. For over 3 years, he traveled across the southeast, often alone in the wilderness. As he was traveling, the activities that led to the American Revolution were taking place. He was involved in several significant events in Georgia and became friends with important Georgians. Bartram was in Augusta for the historic 1773 meeting with the Indians that resulted in the land cession of that year. That led to an invitation to accompany the surveying party that set out to map the boundaries of the newly acquired land. He also went to the Georgia coast, where he was a guest of Lachlan McIntosh, soon to be Continental Commander in Georgia. Bartram toured Florida, at one point joining Indian traders in their trips to Indian villages. Back in Georgia, he went to Cherokee Mountain towns and then into Tennessee and Alabama. By the time he left Georgia for the last time in late fall 1776, he had traveled in North and South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. Along the way, he had kept a detailed journal and some drawings of the plant and animal life he encountered. By the time his expedition ended, the colonies had declared their independence and the war was on. Bartram published his travels in 1791, and it quickly became popular, especially in Europe. Since that time, it has remained one of the most read travel accounts. Today, Bartram's trail is identified with markers, allowing modern adventurers to follow in Bartram's footsteps.